Welcome, everyone, to the Vital Conversation. We're so glad you're here, and we're even more excited that you're interested in talking about vitalism. So this conversation is brought to you by the Naturopathic Medicine Institute. The Institute envisions a world where enjoying optimal health allows people to reach their highest potential for inspired creativity. It asserts that the highest ideal in healthcare must act in concert with the healing power of nature. So this little intro here is from Dr. Jim Sensenig, and it speaks to why we're doing what we're doing.
We're doing it because I and many people in the profession are concerned that there is a time-honored way of making sense out of medicine and healing and the role of the physician, and in a way that can result in better outcomes than we see in our culture. And we in the Vitalist School, the people who have the great privilege of, you know, being the progeny, I suppose, of those many thinkers, physicians, male and female, indigenous healers and others who have examined this, we have this beautiful way, this almost seemingly secret way of understanding how this phenomenon works to the benefit of all and to the benefit of those who are in service to others. And we are not capturing that or articulating that as well as we could in our current practices. We all have more to learn. We all have something to build on. And we want to bring that back in a way that it not only doesn't get lost, but that it informs us so that we can be the kind of physicians that we want to be in service to those who need our help. I think that's where we're going. And then on the practical level, we want to talk about it. We want to examine it. We want to unpack it. We want to be able to express these underlying principles so that they're not only understood, but they're understood to be inviolate. And on the most practical level, we need to teach each other how they can be applied to the benefit of the human race and the rest of the world, for that matter.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Eli Camp. Welcome to the Vital Conversation. We have a special two-hour presentation today by Dr. Jim Sensenig on infectious disease, and so I'm just going to turn the floor over and give him the floor.
Thank you, Dr. Camp, and thank you, everybody, for joining me again on another Vital Conversation. And let's just dive right into today's topic. We are going to talk about infectious, so that should be in quotes, by the way, infectious disease without using antibiotics or vaccinations. For those of you who know me, you can probably guess that this subject, as much as anything, really pushes my buttons. It evokes an emotional response in me, which I'll explain in a minute. And I hope for that reason I don't get too emotional or carried away with the subject. What it frames for me as a naturopathic doctor who's been in practice for 40 years is the fact that we're even having a question about vaccinations and the use of antibiotics in our profession makes me feel, as someone who's been doing this for a long time, like somehow many in the profession, and particularly our schools, have missed the boat somewhere. Most CE lectures are all about the science and all about the evidence and all about that kind of thing, and they're very clinical, of course. I am not a researcher. I'm not an academician. I'm a clinician. I've been in practice for a long time, and I've had a very successful practice. And those of you who know me and have been in the office with me or have talked to me or consulted with me know where I'm coming from on that. In these 40 years or a little bit less, I have seen practically every so-called infectious disease you can think of, from otitis to pneumonia to gangrene to HIV to whooping cough to mumps and measles. I don't think I've seen rubella, but on and on and on and on. The number of times that I've used antibiotics in those 4 decades, I could count on maybe one hand, maybe 2 hands, maybe 2 hands and both feet, maybe even twice that. But if we're talking about 40 times in 40 years, that's an exaggeration. I think it's probably less than once a year. And you might say, how can that be done? And that, of course, is what we're going to talk about. And for those of you who understand naturopathic medicine, it shouldn't be that much of a question. It brings us to something that we talk about in philosophy all the time, which is that before you can understand or describe or paint the picture that is vitalist philosophy, the progenitor to naturopathic medicine, one has to understand this concept of paradigms. And the whole study of paradigms, and I'm not going to get off on that because I could talk about that all day, as you probably know. But the paradigm in which naturopathic medicine is grounded is completely distinct from and different from the paradigm in which allopathic medicine exists. At that level, the two do not meet. They are diametrically opposed in many ways, or at the very least, are based on different assumptions about what's true in the physical world. One of the books that I want to refer to today is one that some of you may be aware of that's called Dissolving Illusions. It's by Susan Humphreys, who's a medical doctor, and I'll come back to that. But in the opening, I think in the preface of her book, one of the questions that she asks, and by the way, Dissolving Illusions is about the historical misinformation about infectious disease and vaccinations. What Humphrey says in the beginning of this book is, why do we believe something? Is it because everybody else believes it? Is it because our family and our community believe it? Is it because we're told to believe it by someone who's in a position of power or respect? Were we taught to believe it in school? Do we believe it because the idea has existed for a long time? What if what we believed was nothing more than an illusion? And then she goes on to talk about what she's going to introduce in her book about infectious disease and vaccination. What I want to say here, or is I want to, first of all, congratulate her for putting that in such simple terms, but also it's relevant to what we want to talk about when it comes to infectious disease, and it's relevant to this business about paradigms. You may recall that some have said that Einstein was supposed to have said at some point in his life, remember that the best science once said that the world was flat. And you also might know with this idea of paradigms, it's not just thinking outside the box. It's throwing away the box and getting into a new understanding, a new group of assumptions, a new worldview. The paradigm argument's been studied again in depth, and it's such that if you, and this is important to what we're going to talk about, and then I'll move on from this subject. If you understand the existing paradigm and you move into a new paradigm, and these things have shifted throughout human history, and they're always shifting. That's another thing, by the way, parenthetically. How can we be so insistent on the fact that today's science and today's evidence is correct when we have a historical record of that shifting throughout all of human history? In any case, if you understand an existing paradigm and you move to a new paradigm, whether that's Newtonian physics to quantum physics, whether that's a flat Earth to a round Earth, you can obviously understand the older paradigm because you understood it before you shifted into the newer paradigm. To use an example, if you think that the world is flat and then you come to understand that the world is round, obviously you know that the world is round, but you can also understand the perspective of a flat world. However, those who have studied paradigm shifts or paradigm changes in detail, and this is a matter of academic inquiry. This isn't my stuff. This is the stuff of the
field of this kind of consciousness shift. Once you understand the shift, or once you're in the shift, then again, you can understand what was prior. But if you're still in the prior, if you are living in a flat earth, there is no way that you can understand the concept of a round earth. If you're living in the world of Newtonian physics, there's no way that you can understand quantum physics. There's just no way that it's possible because there are different assumptions involved. That is to say, there's no way to communicate across paradigms. And one of the things that bothers me, and I suppose you can hear it in my voice and my emotional reaction here, is that what's happening in naturopathic medicine, at least in this last 30 or 40 years, is that more and more and more of our schools, more and more and more of our practitioners are beginning to practice or moving in a way of practice in the allopathic model, using that as the so-called standard of care, and more damagingly, if that's a word, to a profession and to the public, thinking in the conventional way. The conventional way of medicine is a dismal failure. It's the most expensive one on the planet. We have the sickest country in the world, and in terms of chronic disease. And one of the things that I see from my seat as a naturopathic doctor, who not only practices in a community and a region now for this 35, 40 years, but I also teach in a number of colleges and programs around here where I'm encountering the inquisitive public, you might say. They are not looking for naturopathic doctors who do what their medical doctors do. I'm sure you know that or you wouldn't be on this call. They're looking for somebody who represents a different way of thinking about things and can help them with their problems without the prednisone and the antibiotics and the vaccines and so on. So that said, the conventional approach to infectious disease, as you all know, is that infectious diseases, by definition, are caused by these little itty-bitty invisible microbes. By the way, I remember Howie Mandel, when he was just getting started as a comedian, did this great routine about, as a five-year-old, his mother was trying to explain to him how he was sick because there were these little invisible creatures running around in his body. And if you can ever find that, it's a hilarious kind of scenario here where this young kid is trying to understand and, of course, thinks his mother is nuts because she's talking about these invisible beings. Of course, they've been identified, and in Western medicine, we point to Pasteur's having done that, Louis Pasteur. Now, some of you probably know that Pasteur originally worked on a method. His original motivation was to understand fermentation. And he was doing this, as many of you know, I hope, he was not doing this because he was interested in medicine or disease. He was interested in why or how wine ferments. He was employed by and sponsored by one of the largest and the best-known wineries or vineyards in France. And his undertaking was for commercial purposes, to make a better wine or to understand how that's done. There were other people at the time who were working on that as well, and one of his contemporaries was a fellow named Beauchamp, but there are many others as well who were working on this problem. History suggests that Pasteur appropriated some of the work of his contemporaries, particularly that of Beauchamp, and from Beauchamp's own writings later in Beauchamp's life, he implies that Pasteur kind of got it wrong. In any case, Pasteur first went to the French Academy, the Royal Academy of Sciences in France, in the 70s, in the 1870s, with the idea of his physiology of fermentation. And then it wasn't until later in 1878 that he presented a paper on the germ theory and its relationship to the etiology of certain diseases. Now, if you look at that, if you read that, you will see that he unequivocally comes to the conclusion that certain microbes cause, and those are his words, cause certain diseases. He says that there's no doubt that there's such a thing as an infectious, contagious disease that is caused by these microbes. However, I would challenge you to read the original papers, at least the ones in English, and read it from the perspective of a vitalist, because there's a missing phrase in there that doesn't come through, and that is that the germs, and they didn't have names for these things, by the way, then. He uses the word germ and bacteria and microbe interchangeably. He's talking about how these microorganisms cause disease under certain circumstances. But the under certain circumstances is left out. It's just sort of implied. Now, that's my reading of Pasteur's papers. However, Beauchamp would agree with me on that, because Beauchamp, who was, again, a contemporary, was doing work on fermentation as well, and he suggests in his work that the bacteria or the microbes are arising in living systems as a result of the circumstances or the conditions, what today we would call the terrain. So, which is it? Do germs cause disease, or are germs arising from diseased tissue in some way where the conditions are correct? Well, let's come back to that. Koch, at the same time, was doing some of this work, or a little later than this, in Berlin, and you all know Koch for the Koch's postulates that are put forward in Microbiology 101. In order to prove that a microbe causes a disease, we have to show that the microorganism can be isolated from cases of the disease, that it can then be grown individually or separately in culture, that it can be, or that when it is inoculated into a susceptible animal, the disease must result, and then from that resulting disease, we must once again be able to isolate the microorganism. Well, that's a circular definition, I think. When you look at the third postulate, you have to be able to produce the disease by inoculating or introducing the microbe into a susceptible animal. Well, what if the animal's not susceptible? What if the human's not susceptible? Seems like it breaks down right there. We'll come back to that as well. I put a note, or I put an indication in the notes here about the microbial cloud. That's a term that I had just heard a couple of weeks ago in a discussion about microbes, and this had to do with the human microbiome, and it just caught my attention, because one of the things that I've been saying in the many years that I've been teaching philosophy is that this germ theory seems to suggest, or at least it seems to imply, or maybe for me it implies, that you've got your germs, I've got my germs, and that's that. Like, there's no germs between us. There's no germs. My germs are not talking to your germs, and vice versa. And yet, we know that the world that we live in is sort of this ocean of germs. There's germs everywhere, on every surface, everywhere, all the time, which raises its own questions. If the germs are there all the time, then how do they cause disease? Well, anyway, this talk that I heard just recently about the biome is that you've got bugs all around you, in you, on you, but not only that, you've got your own, and what this microbial cloud refers to is the idea that you've got your own, you know, favorite personal environment of microbes that is moving around with you in this world, almost like another part of you or another body. And this discussion about the microbial cloud was one where the speaker was saying, the day will come when we can identify people by testing their individual microbial cloud. That is to say, that microbial cloud is not only with you, but it is unique to each individual. So that's my way of saying, I suppose, that these guys, these microbes, these germs, these bacteria, these viruses, whatever we're going to call these things, they're everywhere, and they're part of our existence. So moving on, we look at the other side of this. If the germs are everywhere, then do they really cause the problem? Or is it a matter of susceptibility? And the environment matters. Many of the organisms that are blamed for illness are commensal organisms. One of the favorite examples that's used a lot here is Streptococcus. You all know that Streptococci are normal commensal bacteria in the human intestinal tract. You also probably know from Micro 101 that Streptococcus hangs out in the throat, in the pharynx. So it's estimated that something like 40-some percent of people are carriers, meaning they have Streptococcus in their throat, but they don't have a sore throat. So how come when that patient comes to you with a pharyngitis and you can culture Streptococcus, we blame the sore throat on the strep? Isn't it possible that the strep are proliferating in the throat because the conditions for that bacteria that's always been there are now such that it allows for an overgrowth or an increased growth of those bugs? I have to ask the same question with a urinary tract infection with E. coli. I'm sure you know that E. coli is a normal commensal organism. As a matter of fact, some of you, probably no one on this call, is old enough to remember that we used to use E. coli implants orally and rectally when I was first in practice because it's a normal commensal organism, just like all the other probiotics. Oh, by the way, there was an article online yesterday, which I failed to print out, about how probiotics given to infants within the first 27 days of life, I don't know how they figured that one out, reduces the risk of type 1 diabetes by half. Little aside there. So if E. coli is a normal commensal organism, how does it get to be blamed for urinary tract infection? Now, anybody who grows anything knows that the environment or the organism requires a proper environment. My younger brother is a chief muckety-muck in the Forest Service, has his Ph.D. in silviculture, which is the study of the forest environment. And he illustrated this point to me one time by saying this: if you're in Oregon and you're looking at a hillside and you see all those conifers, all you see is conifers. When he looked at the hillside, he sees different stands of different species of trees. He sees Douglas firs here, and he sees something else there and something else there, and they intermingle to some degree, but for the most part, the stands are this species or that species or that species or whatever. Because the conditions for their growth in terms of the nutrients in the soil and the pH of the soil are different for different species. Therefore, a hillside is going to show different stands of trees because the soil is different in different places. Said differently, he, because this is his field of study, he could tell you what the soil conditions are by looking at the hillside because of what's growing there. I once shared a cab with a guy on the way to the airport. I'm in Connecticut, and the closest really big airports are in New York City, and occasionally, instead of using local airports, we take cabs or shuttles to the New York City airports. That's a bit of a drive, but I once shared a cab with somebody, I guess it was a limousine actually, and somehow I got into a discussion about microbes and disease. I don't know who brought it up or how it happened, but the guy that I was in the cab with turns out to be a man who spent his adult career working as a mold abatement specialist in the state of Connecticut, rehabilitating buildings that had been moldy or overgrown with mold. And one of the things he said when this subject came up was, oh, that's really interesting. What we found years ago is, or what we thought years ago, is that we had identified all the different species of mold that are possibly growing in buildings. And then suddenly we identified hundreds of more species when we, are you sitting down? When we changed the media. In other words, the molds that we could identify and the molds that we thought were all of the molds that were relevant were limited by the media in which we were growing these things. Well, if it's true for trees and it's true for mold, it's probably true for people, too. I had a patient hand me an interesting book a few years ago called La Dolce Vita, and it was written by a college professor in this area who spoke of her teenage, or adolescent, I should say, niece, who was having a lot of difficulty in school. It was about a young girl who was overweight. She was suffering from depression. If I remember correctly, she had constipation. She had food problems, food reactions, acne. She was being teased by other kids in school. It was just a terrible situation. And the family decided maybe we should just have her go hang out with our relatives in Italy for the summer, which is what they did. She didn't want to come back. So they allowed her to stay for another academic year in Italy, and then they went to visit her to bring her back. Now, I may have the facts a little out of whack here because it's been a long time since I read this book, but it's still the same gist. They go to visit this young woman. They see a completely new person. She's lost weight. She's now athletic. She's playing on the town soccer team. Her complexion is cleared up. Her health is improved. She's not depressed. She's an attractive, athletic, healthy young woman. What changed? The environment. Again, if it's true for other living things, it's probably true for us. Now, you might know that on this same subject, Lindlar talks about the fact that this discovery of, let me see if I can find that real quickly. When he talks about the introduction, now Lindlar's writing in 1913. Remember that Pasteur went to the French Academy and say with the germ theory idea, the germ theory and its application in medicine, that was in 1880. So here it is 30 years later that Lindlar's writing about this idea. And one of the things that he says is that the idea of this microbes causing disease was able to, I'm quoting here, to furnish the medical profession with a delightfully simple theory as to the origin of disease, comprehensible to the least intelligent. Upon this flimsy basis rests the entire structure of medical theory and medical practice. You might also know that Kent, in his lectures, and that would be 1900, in Kent's lectures on homeopathic philosophy, in the very first lecture, which is on the sick, he says this about this. He who considers disease results to be the disease itself and expects to do away with the disease is insane. It is insanity in medicine. An insanity that has grown out of the milder forms of mental disorder in science. Crazy whims. The bacteria are the results of disease, and in the course of time we will be able to show perfectly that the microscopical little fellows are not the disease cause, but they come after, and that they are perfectly harmless in every respect. They are the outcome of the disease, and they are present wherever the disease is. And by the microscope, it has been discovered that every pathological result has its corresponding bacteria. I'm going to read that again. Think that one through. Every pathological result has its corresponding bacteria. The old school considered these the cause, but we will be able to show you that disease cause is much more subtle than anything that can be shown by a microscope. We will be able to show you by a process of reasoning step by step the folly of hunting for disease cause by the implements of the senses. And for those of you who know more about what Kent's talking about there and who understand the paradigm upon which homeopathy is built will know that he's talking about not just the changes in the tissue, but the changes in the tissue having been preceded by something, and that's a change in the so-called simple substance or the vital force or the internal environment of the person. Virchow is supposed to have said somewhere towards the end of his life, this is the famous microbiologist and physiologist from Russia who said that at the end of his life, that if I had my life to live over again, I would devote it to showing that germs don't cause disease, but they seek diseased tissue in the same way that mosquitoes seek stagnant water. So the point here is, of course, that you change the environment, you change the microbes. You can't grow, you know, as I'm fond of saying in class, anybody who grows anything knows this. If you're going to grow roses, you need different soil than if you're growing rhododendrons. And if you're going to raise certain kinds of this or that or whatever it is, you have to have the right environment in which to do that. Now, this is one way to look at this situation. Are the microbes causing the tissue changes? Are the microbes causing the pathology, the histological changes that we identify with the disease process? Or, as these vitalists are arguing, are the microbes present in abundant, identifiable amounts because the particular conditions of the disease preceded or provided, maybe is a better word, the right environment for those microbes to proliferate? But wait, there's more. There's an argument that started with Beauchamp that's carried through by Lindlar and many others independently throughout the end of the 19th and the early 20th century that take this a step further. And they have suggested, among them, I have them listed in the notes there, these people have suggested that there is a germ, and that's in the most generic sense of that word. There's an animal germ or a vegetable germ, meaning a basic unit of life, called by these different names, microzymes or microsomes or spermids or somatids, that is present in all living cells, and that living germ cell, as Pasteur actually refers to it, changes and expresses itself in different forms, or what we identify as different forms, under different conditions. Gaston Lussans in the 1940s, who's a French-Canadian, was demonstrating that these spermatids, which he called them, or somatids, I'm sorry, which he called them, were present in all living cells. They were not destroyed by heat or by radiation or any other method that was known, and that when cells are abnormal, let's say sick, the somatid changes in its morphology and becomes identified as what we call microorganisms. Now, this also arises in Lindlar's work because he asked this question, where do the bacteria come from in the first place? Are they actually independent of other living organisms, or do they come from living organisms? This, and I don't know what the answer is, but I think it's an intriguing way to think about this. Because what they're saying here is that when you have a normal, healthy cell, whether you're talking any living thing, animal or vegetable, when you have a healthy living cell, these things do not express themselves. And then when there's a compromise in the health of the cell, i.e. when the chemistry changes, then these microbes begin to show up in an identifiable way, and they do their thing. Now, that's consistent with what Kent says in his lectures 100 years ago, where he suggests that the microbes are the scavengers of the disease process, that their job is that they're not just showing up, so to speak, because the conditions have changed. They're showing up because they're the cleanup crew. It's their job to get rid of the so-called morbid matter. So it's an interesting idea. It would suggest that, and it's kind of intriguing from a sort of a philosophical perspective. You know, what it really kind of says there is that living organisms have within them the necessary microbes, or the necessary mechanism, I suppose, to return dust to dust. And the question here would be, when a tree falls in the forest and then it decays over time, where it goes back to what we call soil or the earth, how do the bacteria which decay or are responsible for the decay of that tree find the tree? Are they hanging out somewhere waiting for the tree to fall? Is it because there's a cloud of bacteria in the forest, or the tree has its own cloud of bacteria? Or is it because the microbes themselves are brought into action, so to speak, by the death of the cells of the tree? Don't know. But it's a completely different way of thinking than having the germ be the cause. So when we get into the treatment then of infectious disease, oh, by the way, I was, parenthetically, I got into a discussion this morning with one of my associates here in the office, and we found ourselves saying this, which I'm not prepared to talk about in any depth, but it's something to think about. This is not just an academic question. This is a simple idea which, understood in the way that it's now understood in our culture, has affected the trajectory of human history. What we have done, as Lindlar says, in this delightfully simple way of understanding disease, has changed the way medicine is practiced, not only in the United States, but in the world, moving it into the largest employer in the United States, one of the largest commercial enterprises on the planet, and it has affected the way we think, not only in the way we think about medicine and the way we think about disease, but one might say it's affected the way we think about politics and so on and so forth. The whole idea of contagion and infection could be applied to the way we're looking at the political map today. It is a huge, huge industry when you think about it. Vaccinations and antibiotics. It's led to antibiotics in our food. It's affecting us on levels that we have no way of really understanding in depth, and perhaps has not just changed the course of our political and economic history, but it might be changing who we are. Anyway, that said, in this vitalist world, the germs are not the enemy. They are us. We are them. We're all in this together, and they are beneficial. All of this work, if you have been on a previous call when we talked about digestive health, the astounding amount of work that is now being done on the human biome and the bacteria in the body show that the bacteria, the microbes, are involved in every function, every physiological function you can think of, and individual species of bacteria are associated with different kinds of symptoms, from different bugs that are being identified in the skin, being identified in anxiety, in autism, in ulcerative colitis, and so on and so forth. So, is the bug causing the problem, or is the problem causing the bug? So when we get to treatment, we have to realize that if we take this model seriously, that the illness causes the germs, or at least provides the milieu or the media for the germs. And therefore, we treat the illness, not the germs. When we use antibiotics, we're not just killing the germ, of course, But, you know, when you think about this for a second, in conventional medicine, when you kill the bugs, whether it's the MRSA or it is the strep or it's the E. coli or whatever, you're counting on the individual to return to normal without doing anything in that system, in the conventional system, without doing anything to enhance that possibility or maybe ensure that possibility. Not only does killing the germs then avoid what the vitalist would say is the underlying cause, but it also increases susceptibility for the next time around, because when you kill the bugs, you're killing the good guys too. And this is tantamount to, you know, I said this to somebody the other day, and a patient, and the lights went off. I said, I want you to think about, this is somebody who had an overgrowth of candida in the intestinal tract based on cultures that we had and other testing. So think of the overgrowth of the microbes like algae in a pond. They're there because the pond is stagnant. And if you just kill the algae, you're not only going to have a stagnant pond remaining, but the pond is now more stagnant. That is to say, its physiology is more compromised. So now you've just set this up for another infection. About 2 or 3 weeks ago, I heard a lecture, I won't get into details, but about this thing that people like to call SIBO, the small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. The speaker was talking about how to identify the bacteria in the gut, which is basically redundant because you just still use the same treatment, which is an antibiotic, rifaxin. And she was saying that what we do is we use antibiotics to kill off the bacteria. And then the bad news is that it often comes back again and again and again. So we have to use antibiotics again. Well, how can that be a sane or rational treatment if you're just doing that? So it makes the point, I guess, of what I'm talking about here. We're increasing susceptibility to an infectious disease when we use antibiotics to kill off all of the bacteria. Not to mention all the bacteria, I mean the bacteria, all the antibiotics that are in our food. I keep hearing this statistic thrown around that there's more antibiotics used in agriculture, that is to say growing animals, than in the healthcare system, which of course means that we all have small amounts of antibiotics in our bodies depending on what we're eating. Of course, the main problem or criticism here with the antibiotic approach is ignoring the underlying cause of the disease in the first place, which is the pathological change, not the bugs. I see in my notes that I say note ante. This is a really good place to throw in a philosophical argument. Have you noticed that most of the drugs, if not all of the drugs that are used in allopathic medicine, start with the prefix ANTI, antibiotic, anti-phlogistic, anti-inflammatory, anti-febrile, anti-anti-anti-anti-anti. That's because that's the definition of allopathic medicine, right? This is where we're working to suppress the symptom, i.e. working against what the body is doing in its reaction to the current situation in which it finds itself. In other words, in the vitalist model, we understand that the symptoms are the wholly predictable changes that are occurring in a living system because of its imbalance. And instead of trying to stop or thwart the reactive changes, or more properly, the compensatory changes, we want to get to the underlying problem. So a rational treatment would suggest that you treat the underlying problem. So how do you do that? Well, that's the stuff of naturopathy. That's what you're always doing, hopefully, is treating the underlying problem. Now, this is where you might be saying to yourself, but what does that have to do with somebody who walks in with a puncture wound with their finger swollen? Or what does that have to do with somebody who's got otitis media? Or for that matter, like somebody I saw this morning who has a hemolytic E. coli infection of the large intestine. or. Well, it has everything to do with it. Because the therapies that you are using as a naturopathic doctor are directed at treating the underlying cause, not killing the bacteria. I was reminded today of a patient that we saw here just a few months ago, and this has happened to me several times in the years I've been in practice, where somebody comes in with a child who is quite ill, in this case high fever, listless, dilated pupils, skin is hot and red, and both ears are inflamed. So I'm looking at the child, I'm listening to mom's description as they are moving from our waiting area into one of the exam rooms. I go to our dispensary, I get a homeopathic remedy, and I go into the exam room, administer to the child, and as God is my witness, there are occasions where the child, who was just moments before being held in mom's arms, moaning, is back out in the waiting room playing with the Legos or the dinosaurs or something else, like a miracle. Well, it's not a miracle if you understand homeopathy, of course. But the remedy was not directed at whatever microorganism may have been in the ear, but rather to the child and the child's vital force, you might say, in order to make the correction. So what can we do? Well, we can use homeopathy. We can use botanical medicines. We can use anything and everything that stimulates the immune system, from the wet socks treatment that most of you or all of you know about, I hope, hydrotherapy in its different forms, immune enhancing nutrients that we know about, whether it be selenium or vitamin D or vitamin C, and on 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 and on. If you're going to use things that you might think of as antimicrobial, I don't like to think of them that way. I think of them as sort of eumicrobial, you know, correcting the normal microbial environment. You want to use those that we know will affect the, quote, pathogenic bacteria and not affect the others. And some examples that I'm aware of are things like Hydrastis and berberine, allium, of course, calendula, oregano. So those all are directed at correcting the problem. This might be a good place to also add in that the normal environment in the gut and the normal environment in the system select for or provide the milieu for the good guys and the commensal bacteria and make it unlikely or less hospitable for the bad guys. That's the whole lecture about the pH of the gut and hydrochloric acid and normal bacteria and pathogenic bacteria, and that's from another day. So I am going to catch my breath and have a sip of water here, and then I'm going to go through some examples from my own practice over the last few years, and then I guess we'll take questions. I don't know why this just came to mind, but I remember having talking about this subject in one of the naturopathic schools, and somebody said to me with respect to strep throat, well, isn't it true that an untreated strep infection can result in other problems like scarlet fever and glomerulonephritis and so on? And the answer is yes, of course. But we're not talking about untreated. We're talking about treated. We're just not treating with antibiotics. We're treating with something else. And in my experience, these treatments are safer, have no side effects, are less costly, and are more effective, and frankly, they're quicker acting. So I've listed a number of so-called infectious diseases that I have seen, some of which, many of which, if not most of which, I've seen in practice. And I want to go through those in terms of treating those illnesses. And then, of course, that'll get us into the question of vaccination as well. So, strep throat. Those of you who are in an eclectic or a family practice kind of situation, notice I didn't say primary care. If somebody wants to ask about that later, I'll tell you why that should push the buttons of anybody who's doing naturopathic medicine. But in any case, if you're doing an eclectic family practice or naturopathic practice, how many times a year do you see somebody who's got a streptococcal pharyngitis? Easily, in my experience, easily treated. How? Well, homeopathy comes to mind. There are many remedies that are useful there. And, of course, those of you who understand homeopathy, and unfortunately, I have to say this, I don't think it's all of us, because I don't think the schools are really emphasizing it like it was, you know, half a century ago. In any case, the remedy for somebody with a streptococcal pharyngitis is the remedy that's homeopathic to the case. Now, obviously, there are some remedies that come up more often than others because there are certain histological features that are seen more often than not. But that said, in the case of a strep pharyngitis, perhaps the most common remedy that we find ourselves using is Merck-Viv. That's particularly true if there's pain on swallowing, and especially if it's worse on the right than on the left. Phytolacca comes to mind. And, of course, the strep nosode comes to mind. Before I leave homeopathy, let me make I hope and pray that everybody on this call knows what a nosode is. A nosode is the, well, there's a couple ways to define it. A nosode is actually technically the disease product itself. That is to say, the pus or the mucus or the discharge from whatever that disease is, which these days we know in most cases will contain the organism. And or you could use, in this case you could use streptococcal nosode. There are other things that you can use as well, of course. You can use those things that might have an antimicrobial effect, maybe I should say a normalizing effect, and gargle with salt water with, I mean, you all know this, honey, salt water, lemon juice. Hydrastis is one of my favorites. I have people take straight tincture of hydrastis or usually hydrastis. I don't know about echinacea. I don't even know if it works as an antimicrobial, which many people think. But also one of my favorite treatments for a strep throat is orificial ultraviolet. What's that? Ultraviolet light that is administered or is directed at the pharynx through a wand, which is made for orificial use. Back in the old days, when I was in school 100 years ago, we used orificial ultraviolet light for throat, mouth, problems like thrush, like streptococcus, for ear infections in the ear canal, and believe it or not, vaginally for vaginal infections. I don't even know where you buy those things anymore, but I'm guessing they're still around somewhere. Also, physical medicine, of course, for a strep throat. Some of you who are conversant with physical medicine will know that sometimes just manipulation of the cervical spine and or using hydrotherapy with various kinds of packs and poultices will help with the strep throat. Pneumonia. I'm going to tell a story. I was teaching over the weekend in a graduate program that I teach here, and one of the students said, I love the way you tell stories because when you do that, I remember. So the story about pneumonia is I had somebody here as a resident a few years ago. I was supervising her work. She saw a young child who was 3 or 4 years old who was coughing his brains out, who came in at a point where I was unable to see the child. She walked out of the exam room, and she said, this is somebody who's just out of school, and she says, I think this kid has pneumonia. Can you check? So anyway, I checked the child. The child had pneumonia, bilateral, lobar pneumonia. And the short story is that I asked her to just pick a remedy that she thought would be homeopathic to the case. In this case, it was bryonia. She also did the wet socks treatment. And 24 hours later, that child, who could hardly breathe, had a high fever, and was brought in his mother's arms, came running in the office under his own power. He was 95% better. I tell the story in part because her surprise was, oh my gosh, I've never seen anything quite like that. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, I've never seen homeopathy work like that. I didn't know you could use it acutely like that. So that's my comment and criticism about what's happening in our schools, but also to demonstrate that properly chosen remedies can work very quickly. And in that case, with the pneumonia, it was only a homeopathic remedy and the wet socks treatment. Otitis media, how many times are you going to see that? Easily treated with upper cervical manipulation, poultices, and homeopathy. My favorite remedies that come to mind there are Calimur and Ferrum Fos, but it could be anything. It could be chamomile, pulsatilla, calcarb, depends on the child, obviously. Perianal fistulas, I've seen a lot. That's, of course, supposed to be an infectious problem, and in conventional medicine would be treated with antibiotics. Silica is really good for pustules of all kinds, in fact, carbuncles and furuncles and so on and so forth, as is Heparin Sulf. But also, those of you who may know about the product called C-Cure, absolutely incredible for wound healing and for those kinds of things I just mentioned where the healing from the bottom up, that is from the inside out, is accelerated greatly by that. Food poisoning. Again, the remedy that comes to mind here would be the constitutional remedy, and the list goes on and on and on. The one that seems to be employed most here would be something like arsenicum. Sinusitis, same argument here. My favorite remedies for sinusitis, I think, are probably, again, we're talking about the constitutional, but often we find that that's a calibichromium, or one of my favorites is actually something called mesurum. Conjunctivitis, same thing, and I'm sure you know that there are all kinds of hydrotherapy treatments there with hot packs to the eyes. Again, upper cervical and cervical manipulation. Again, anything that enhances the immune system. There's a gazillion products available to us now that were not around when I was in school. I'm not going to name them, but you know what I'm talking about, these various acute immune products that contain things like, you know, vitamin A and vitamin C and zinc and selenium and often echinacea, some of the medicinal mushrooms. Sometimes they have glandular extracts in them from lymph to spleen to thymus to thyroid and on and on and on. Did I mention zinc? Did I mention vitamin E? Did I mention vitamin D? So those kind of products, as well as the topical applications, as well as physical medicine, and remedies that come to mind for conjunctivitis, chamomile, very often, particularly if it's one eye more than the other, calcarb, sanguinaria nitrate, is a pretty good one, and there again, the list goes on and on and on. Speaking of which, before I forget, I should tell you about a really good resource from a homeopathic point of view is a book known as Practical Homeopathic Therapeutics. Again, that's Practical Homeopathic Therapeutics, and it's by W.A. Dewey, D-E-W-E-Y. It was published, I think, in 1906. Dewey goes through the treatment Well, first of all, in his preface, he presumes a knowledge of homeopathy, and he presumes that one knows that the prescribing for the totality of the symptoms is going to be done by the prescriber. That said, he goes on to look at the remedies that, in his practice, came up most frequently for various kinds of problems. The reason I recommend the book is because amongst those various problems are this whole list of infectious diseases that we're talking about, from whooping cough to mumps and measles. Parenthetically, no, it's not parenthetical at all. Let me say this. One of the things that's interesting about this book, again, published in 1905 or 1906, is that Dewey points out that he started in medical practice before Pasteur, and that, therefore, he and his colleagues were practicing medicine before we knew about microbes. And, importantly, we, he says in the book, were curing these diseases before we knew that there were microbes. So what's the microbe have to do with it? You know, of what possible importance is that? So anyway, if you're new to this subject or if you're looking for some confidence in choosing your remedies, consult Dewey's book about the possible treatments for these various infectious diseases or so-called infectious diseases, because here's a man with 50-some years of experience who knew what worked. Anyway, back to where were we? So the good old flu, influenza, well, there's a myriad number of remedies that have the symptoms of flu, ranging from Eupatorium to Gelsimium to the old Psilocoxinium and so on and on and on. How about the common cold? If it's really caused by a rhinovirus, then, again, anything that enhances the immune system, anything that increases that vital force, and I don't mean to be leaving out everything else, but I guess I have here by exclusion, physical medicine, acupuncture, homeopathy, botanical medicine, all the things that we have at our disposal. Whooping cough. Oh, my God, whooping cough. You know, what are we going to do about it? It's such a, you know, dangerous disease and yada, yada, yada. The remedies that have been employed with good results, again, from a homeopathic point of view, is a list as long as your arm. I mean, it's Drosera, it's Cuprum, it's Magfos, it's Arnica, yes, Arnica, and then even Pertussin. But again, I would, since I'm a naturopathic doctor, I wouldn't do just the remedy. I would employ these other immune-enhancing things that I keep referring to. Mumps, same thing, the constitutional remedy, immune-enhancing treatments. Belladonna comes to mind, Rustox maybe, mercury, mumps, pilocarpus, measles, same argument. Remedies that are found useful there include gelsimium, ferrum fos, pulsatilla sometimes, calimur, chickenpox. We'll talk about chickenpox a little more in a minute when we get into vaccinations, but who's afraid of the big bad wolf here? I mean, so what if you get chickenpox? I mean, who cares? In fact, it's going to confer immunity for chickenpox for some time and probably immunity for shingles, right? Calimur, Rustox come to mind. And then hepatitis. I've seen all three hepatitises over the years, the hepatitis A, B, C. Of course, there are others, as you know. I have always had good luck with hepatitis by simply using some of those products that are made for lipotrophic purposes. There are some products by that name, lipotropic complex. And these are the ones that are reputedly for fat metabolism, that increase the bile flow from the liver and used along with the other things I mentioned and then the appropriate remedy. And the appropriate remedy is possibly the nosodes for each of those you know, hepatitis A and B and C individually, but also botanically, Chelidonium, Chionanthus. And again, the nosodes, which I just mentioned. And then, of course, this is the 21st century, and we do have antibiotics. And I think I have to grudgingly admit that there is a time and a place for antibiotics. I mean, after all, if the patient is not responding and we have an overgrowth of these microbes, doesn't it make sense to kind of knock down the microbes to allow the healing power of nature or the normal physiology to be restored in this individual? But if you understand the practice of naturopathic medicine, as I think we all could and should, antibiotics would be a last resort. If it's in the best interest of the patient, then we need to do it. But my experience has shown me that they're seldom necessary. And of course, when they are, then it's a good thing that we have them. We don't really need to get into, at this point, what the side effects are of the overuse of antibiotics in our culture, which, of course, are myriad, but the two biggest problems are the widespread use of antibiotics is not only making us more susceptible to other microbes or changing the milieu in their direction, but it's also creating the superbugs that the world is worried about now. So I'm going to take a deep breath and get another sip of water here. Now, that brings us to this whole thing about vaccination. And I'm assuming that most of the people on the call are naturopathic physicians, although I don't know that for sure. And it's my opinion that this issue about vaccination is going to divide the profession if it hasn't already. In my opinion, it's not because of pro-vaccination versus anti-vaccination, as much as it is that the argument for vaccination is a symptom of this underlying problem of not understanding how infectious disease works or the argument about terrain. Without the germ theory of disease, we have no need for vaccinations. But we're living at a time of almost, you know, panic about germs. And we're living in a germ-phobic culture. We have antibacterial hand washes and antibacterial this and antibacterial that and so on and so forth. Now, you know, those of you who have been paying attention know that the antibacterial stuff in our environment is increasing our resistance to various health problems. The classical example is that of asthma. Children who are raised in the countryside, who live on farms, who are rolling around in the grass and the dirt and animal stuff, have the most robust immune systems. And as we get further and further away from that kind of exposure to the natural world, we have increasing rates of autism, to where those who are living in these like bacteria-free environments or the environments that are trying to be that way are more likely to have an asthmatic condition. I can't quote you the numbers of the studies, but I know they've been around for a long time. There are studies that show that those who wash their hands, particularly in medicine, like the surgeons who wash their hands, have more pathogenic, that is to say, more virulent, quote-unquote, bacteria on their hands than people who don't wash their hands because they're destroying the underlying, the oils that are on the hands. So there's a lot of arguments to be made about this. I remember years ago I had an infant who was here for reasons I don't remember. I don't remember anything about this child except for what I'm about to tell you, which is In doing a physical exam, I reached for an otoscope and put a specula on the otoscope, and I was about to look in the child's ear when the mother freaked out on me. She said, wait, is that sterile? I said, no, it's not sterile. And by the way, neither is your baby. She wouldn't let me look in this kid's ear because I didn't have a sterile otoscope. So that's the degree to which some people are living in fear of bugs. And that fear gets whipped into an almost frenzy when we start talking about vaccinations, including the belief that if I don't get vaccinated, I'm somehow going to be putting you, who are vaccinated, at risk. So let's back up a little bit. First of all, if you are with me on what I've just talked about in this last hour, we're looking at diseases which are avoidable or preventable or treatable in the first place. So what's the big deal? But this idea of susceptibility is simply not addressed in the conventional world, and it's not part of our culture. You know, it seems like it's a no-brainer. At every time in history where there have been infectious disease outbreaks, if you want to call them that, there are people who are harmed, there are people who are sickened, and there are people who die. But there's also a whole lot who don't. In my classes, those of you who have had classes with me know that I like to use one of the opening scenes from Monty Python and the Search for the Holy Grail, where we have the scene that many of you, or hopefully many of you, know, where we have, I guess it's called the coroner or the coroner's wagon. We have this guy pulling a wagon on which dead bodies are being loaded by the villagers as the crier says, bring out your dead, bring out your dead, bring out your dead. And we see people coming with bodies and flopping them on this cart. And that's a perfect visual illustration of what was happening at the time of the bubonic plague. You have people living in filth and, you know, muck and mud and human waste, which is being just tossed out of the hut or the home into the streets or the lanes or whatever. There's no understanding of microbes or the corollary, which is sanitation. So we have people living in the muck and the mire, touching each other, sleeping with each other, presumably being intimate with each other, and some of them are dying. But some of them are living, including people who are handling the bodies of those who are dying. In fact, it's estimated that during the Black Plague that one-third of the people in Europe died from that, quote, infection. By the way, Linlar asked this question. If the bubonic plague is caused by a bacteria that lives in the fleas and the rats, where did the rat get it? And how did the flea get it? Where did it come from in the first place? Anyway, for another time. So about one-third, it's estimated about one-third of people in Western Europe died from the plague in that 14th century. But that means two-thirds of them lived. So what's the difference between the one-third and the two-third? And this is always happening. In the 1918 flu epidemic in the United States, several million people died, so they say, from the flu. What about the people that lived? Were they not exposed to the same virus? Or how do you explain that? And by the way, those of you who are familiar with the argument about the homeopathic hospitals at the time and the allopathic hospitals at the time know that the allopathic hospitals lost huge numbers of patients as a percentage of what they saw, where the homeopathic hospitals lost very, very few patients. Look at the Ebola virus thing that just went on in North Africa here a couple of, is it a year ago maybe now? I don't know what the final numbers are, but a few thousand people died from Ebola. But two or three times that number who were infected by Ebola did not die. And the question, of course, is what's the difference? And the only answer is that it's got to have to do with the susceptibility. So we have to believe in the germ theory of disease and the absolute, you know, virulence of the bacteria in order to invoke the idea of vaccinations in the first place. Now, when we criticize vaccinations, we have to mention a couple of things here. There's no argument as a clinician, as a doctor. I've seen the results of some people with infectious disease, but I've also seen the results of some people who have been vaccine damaged. There's no argument against the idea of active immunity. But why do it with vaccinations when there are equally effective or more effective ways to confer immunity without any side effects whatsoever? Vaccinations, as they are used in the United States, are causing a great deal of damage. Now, from where I sit in practice after almost 40 years, I have seen many, many children who have suffered vaccine damage. And you all know the story. The normal, healthy child who meets all of their milestones and is the pride of their parents, who then has their MMR or their DPD, or what is it, DT, I can't even think now, who has their immunization and they have a reaction and they fall asleep. Or, as one child I saw just recently, was in a coma for 3 or 4 days. By the way, when the parents, the stories that I have heard, and these are stories, so they're anecdotal, the stories that I hear is while the parents are driving home with the kid now screaming in the back seat because their thigh is the size of a watermelon, or they call back and say, my child has gone into a deep sleep, which turns out to be a coma, and they call the pediatrician. The pediatrician says, that has nothing to do with immunization. That's just a coincidence. Now, whether the pediatrician's talking about that to cover their backside or whether they really believe that, either way, they're not reporting that to the adverse effects office in the FDA or the CDC. So obviously, we don't have a database that shows that there's any vaccine damage from this or that or the other thing. We know, and the FDA knows, and the CDC knows, that there is neurological damage from some vaccines. And we also know, just by reading the insert of the vaccine, the package insert for the vaccines, that one can become colonized especially when we're using live viruses, you can be colonized by the bug and become a carrier. In fact, it's suggested that the whole measles thing in Disneyland a few months ago, or a year ago, whatever it was now, was one where those who were vaccinated were the ones who were spreading. They're the source of the outbreak. And I think there is some evidence to suggest that. In any case, there's been work done to show that that's the case, especially the work of Andrew Wakefield, who is a medical doctor from London, who shows that children who get their MMR have residual measles virus, rubeola virus in their intestinal tract, sort of a subclinical colitis from this. Of course, he's dragged through the mud, he's disbarred or loses his license because everybody knows that that can't be true. Anyway, we also know, or maybe you know, that, and I just learned this recently, that many of the pharmaceutical companies are genetically modifying the microbes that they're using in order to be able to patent them. And so now we have genetically modified organisms that are being injected into our kids. And then, of course, there's the argument that the adjuvant itself may be problematic. One of the arguments for that, by the way, is I understand that Cuba boasts the highest immunization rates in the world, one of the best medical systems in the world. Somewhere close to 98-99% of children are immunized against childhood diseases, and there is little in the way of neurological damage or autism in that country. So do immunizations cause autism? No, but the CDC knows that immunizations cause neurological damage, so how do you separate those things out? One of the things that I have to say about vaccination, again, is it's not the idea of active immunity, it's the way it's being done. And if you look at the history of vaccination, from Dewey's book, for example, that I mentioned before, and other writers, if you read what our predecessors had to say at the beginning of the 20th century, as they were watching this thing come on with the mandatory vaccinations and so on, they had raised many questions about the problems that were occurring with vaccination after, according to them, the idea of using small amounts of the disease product to evoke immunity was taken from and out of context from homeopathic medicine. I read one writer who said that the problem started when the allopaths started injecting this stuff hypodermically, i.e. under the skin. Because before that, the homeopaths were using various remedies and nosodes, as we talked about before, to treat these problems. Anyway, it's hard to estimate what the damage is and what the problems are, but there is a downside. And obviously, if you sort of look at vaccinations from a public health point of view, I guess you could make an argument for them. The argument would be that the one that's used in allopathic medicine for everything that they do, which is a risk-benefit ratio. How many children are we saving from assumed or presumed doom at what cost to the general population in terms of side effects? But this is a spurious argument as far as I'm concerned, because the first thing that you're taught in medicine is do no harm, not do no harm if you can show that there's a benefit. Do no harm. It's an absolute. Because allopathic medicine, the suppression of symptoms without treating the underlying cause, causes harm. And that's indisputable. Every medication that's used allopathically, notice how I said that, every medication that's used allopathically, and that can include natural stuff too, every medication that's used allopathically has side effects. That's because the medicine is applied to suppress a symptom, and because every medication has an effect on the whole body. If you look back at Spittler's writing in 1948 in Basic Naturopathy, he asks this question and then answers it. How does the medicine know where to go? How does the medicine know to go to your heart or your kidneys? Or your lungs? And of course, the answer is it doesn't. It goes everywhere. It affects everything in the body. But all drugs have a principal effect, and they have all these other effects. So in allopathic medicine, we're only concerned about the principal effect, and we write off everything else as a side effect. And we justify that in the conventional system by a risk-benefit ratio. I'm sorry, Mr. Smith, that you're losing your hair and your impotence, but at least your blood pressure is normal. Whoops, sorry about the diabetes and the leg pain, but at least we got that cholesterol down, or whatever it happens to be. In rational medicine, in naturopathic medicine, we can't justify the harm by looking at the good. We have to look at the effect that it has on each individual patient. And so that makes it much harder to understand vaccination in the way it's being done. One thing that I put in the notes here, which I think most of you are familiar with, but maybe you're not, is that you cannot file claims for vaccine damage in the United States in court, that is to say, in the regular courts. If you have a claim, you have to go to the vaccine court, which is a administrative court that's administered by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. in the vaccine court, awards have been made since 1986, I think it is. I think I have that. The National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986, I should say, in the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act of 1986, Congress granted immunity to the vaccine manufacturers and those who administer the vaccines because of the rising number of lawsuits alleging vaccine damage or medical injury. So they actually set up a court that hears only those arguments. There's no jury. It's decided by a panel of judges. And since 1986, when that court was formed, the vaccine court has awarded $3.2 billion in injury to people who've been injured or damaged by vaccines. That's a pretty hefty number, I should think. So, again, the argument here, though, is not that the idea of active immunity is a problem, but the way it's being done is a problem. Now, again, in terms of treatment and prevention, you as a naturopathic doctor have a myriad of tools which can be brought to bear here. For example, one of the things that happens is that patients ask me every year around this time about the flu shot, or what can you do instead of the flu shot? Well, what can you do instead of the flu shot? Well, a lot of things you can do. Like, you could be healthy and take care of yourself. I like to recommend to people they take a little bit of extra zinc and a little bit of extra selenium. Selenium, by the way, is decidedly antiviral, even at low doses. Some of you may be aware of the work that Don Warren's a naturopathic doctor in the Toronto area, former president of Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine, who has just finished working many years on a project in Rwanda with the Rwandan government and the World Health Organization, where they treated people with HIV with 200 micrograms, only 200 micrograms of selenium on a daily basis, that greatly extended the onset of symptoms in this case. And that's what they were measuring. There's a lot of research with selenium that's been used for HIV in the United States and hepatitis C. I have seen people's viral loads in those cases come down dramatically with just a small amount of selenium. So anyway, a little extra selenium, a little extra zinc, you know, beats the flu shot hands down. So why can't we give children some selenium or some zinc or some vitamin A or some vitamin E, or for that matter, some vitamin D, or some of the botanical extracts that we're aware of? There's so many different things that will enhance the immune system, probiotics, digestive enzymes. I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on, which will decrease the likelihood that anyone is going to have a reaction to a microbe to which they might be exposed, but also increasing their immune surveillance. Now, on with vaccinations. Way back in the old days, in the last century, when I was in naturopathic school, we were taught how to treat every infectious disease you can think of, from whooping cough to chicken pox to tetanus to rabies. Now, of course, the truth is that most of us don't see those things in practice. And, of course, the argument there would be that because of immunizations, we don't see them so often. Now I bring you back to Susan Humphrey's book, Dissolving Illusions, where she makes the argument that's been made by the public health sector for the last 100 years, which is that the dramatic reduction in infectious disease is not the result of vaccination programs at all, but rather it's the result of increasing sanitation, water supplies, waste disposal, and so on and so forth. I'm not going to try to make that argument here in the short time that we have, But if you want to be conversant with the argument and you want to see the statistics, look at Humphrey's book. It is a compendium of statistics from around the world on how these diseases changed or dropped or disappeared in response to the introduction of public health measures and sanitation. So again, this argument about vaccination is about how it's done, but it also presupposes that you are aware of the fact that all of these infectious or so-called infectious diseases are treatable by other methods. And what are those other methods? Well, again, in terms of infectious, the so-called infectious diseases, there's the immune-enhancing things that we've talked about before for what I, you know, talked about with the sort of bacterial or, you know, daily clinical practice kind of thing. But with every one of these so-called infectious diseases, we have the nosodes, which are available and which with which you must be familiar. But also, we have the other potential, the other remedies that could be used for these diseases as well. And that list is a long list as well. And I guess we don't have them written out there, but the list goes on and on and on and on and on. So, you know, for measles, you can use the rubeola nosode, or what's better known as morbillinum, but also the remedy that might be indicated. That could be anything from, pulsatilla to many others. I'm looking for, where did I put that? In this case, you might be interested in a book called Vaccine Free. The subtitle is Prevention and Treatment of Infectious Contagious Disease with Homeopathy. It's by Kate, K-A-T-E, Birch, like the birch tree. And what Birch does in this book, it goes through every infectious disease that you can think of and tells you not only how to use the nosodes, but also how to use or what other homeopathic medicines might be indicated in that case. So, again, measles could be rubeola. Sometimes it's pulsatilla. It could also be morbillinum, as I mentioned, or euphrasia, for example, and on and on. Diphtheria can be treated with diphtherinum, and I mean, who's seen diphtheria? I mean, we don't even see that anymore, but other remedies that come to mind are mercurius and apis and so on. Some of you might know about tetanus. Of course, you know, tetanus is supposedly caused by Clostridium tetani. By the way, that's a bacteria that's found mostly in animal waste, particularly cattle, cow pies. When's the last time you were around a cow? In fact, I was talking to somebody the other day who came in here with a puncture wound, and he wanted a tetanus shot, but he knew I was a naturopathic doctor, and I told him I can't give him a tetanus shot, but what I can do is give him the remedy for a puncture wound, which is also effective, and this is from understanding this from my teachers and predecessors, is also effective against the possible development of this thing called lockjaw or tetanus. However, I had to say to him, you know that tetanus comes from animal waste and mostly from cow pies, right? Yes. When's the last time you were around a cow or cattle waste? Do you know what a cow is? I mean, how many people even know what cows are anymore? So there's a holdover from our agrarian times where we're still living in fear of tetanus. Tetanus is not caused by a rusty nail. It's caused by a rusty nail in the barnyard where there's a possibility of tetani, and so on. Pertussis, whooping cough. Have you ever seen whooping cough? It's pretty nasty. It's a very, very, very deep barking cough, as you probably know. And there again, Pertussin is a good remedy for whooping cough, but there are many, many other remedies for whooping cough. One that you might want to think about is arnica. Drosera is a good one, Magfos. But yes, arnica for whooping cough, believe it or not. Hepatitis we talked about. Oh, what about polio, you might say? Well, the teachers that I had when I were in school lived through the polio epidemics of the 1950s in the United States, and I'm told that that particular polio was a gelsimium polio. But there are other remedies also, like Lathyrus, and of course, a polio Nosa. So all of these are treatable with the methods that we talked about, but they are also preventable in the same way. Obviously, you are aware of the fact that we can use homeopathy and other natural methods to increase our resistance to something in a prophylactic way. If you know you're going to be exposed to poison ivy, you can take, Anacardium or Roustox. But if you know you're going to be exposed to whooping cough, you could take Pertussin or maybe Arnica or Drosera or the others. So, well understood, the infectious diseases, as naturopathic doctors, the infectious diseases against which we are immunizing people and the infectious diseases with which we're using antibiotics should not concern you so much, because you have effective treatments that, again, are without side effects and much much quicker and much more beneficial than those of the conventional school. I'm going to share one more quick story, and then I'm going to shut up. We had a patient who saw one of the other doctors here a couple of years ago who was being treated for a vaginitis. And she called the next day while that other doctor was not here, and I took the call. She told me that she had just seen Dr. So-and-so, and she was being treated for vaginitis, and today she has severe pelvic pain. She has urinary urgency, and when she urinated this morning, she thought she had blood in her urine. She's in so much pain, she doesn't know what to do. And she was on the phone. I asked her where she was, and she said, I'm on the highway, not far from your office. So I asked her to come in. Long story short, we did a urinalysis. She was urinating blood. It was one of the bloodiest specimens I've ever seen. The cup was full of blood clots, and this woman was in excruciating pain. I gave her a homeopathic remedy. I gave her some botanical extracts. In this case, I think we did a little bit of apis, and what else did I do botanically? And I said, I want you to call me in the morning. She called me the next morning. She said, my symptoms are all gone. I feel great. I have no more problem. I can't believe how quickly this worked, and so much better than if I had been on antibiotics. So I'm going to end there, and we'll take questions.
Well, thank you for that, Dr. Sensenig. So everybody, I'm going to put us in Q&A, which means you can do *6. I have some questions that have been texted in. Q&A, *6 will get you into the Q&A, and I have a few to work through on text, so you have time to text your message in if you can't do the *6. First question is, Dr. Sensenig, was the homeopathic remedy that you used for the puncture wound homeopathic latum?
It was, and also a tetanus nosode.
Second question, and if whoever texted that question to me, because I only have your phone number, I don't have your name in my phone. If you need more than that, go ahead and just text it over. Second question.
Let me comment about the no-sode just quickly. Yep. This is not. We're not talking about theoretical outcomes here. We're talking about measurable, evidence-based outcomes. The fact that the rest of the world doesn't know about this, and particularly in the United States, is irrelevant. In fact, I had this happen. I had another patient who came in who started working on a farm, and he wanted a tetanus shot. And I explained to him that as naturopathic doctors, we don't do that. Long story short, and he was a bit of a skeptic. What we did is we gave him a tetanus, and I don't have his chart in front of me, but if I remember correctly, we gave him a tetanus nosode, probably a 200C. I might have had him take it, you know, once, I don't even remember, because there's no, I mean, there's so many different ways to do this, whether it was once a day or once a week for a while, and then we measured his tetanus antibody, and we could demonstrate a titer against tetanus. And I've seen this over and over again. We have college, in this state, like many states, you can't get into college today unless you can show immunity to mumps, measles, and rubella. And you either have to, quote, have the vaccination, or you have to show immunity, which you can do with raised titers or elevated titers. Well, what we do is we give the patient the mumps, measles, and rubella nosodes, and then we measure their titers. And we can demonstrate that the titers are acceptable proof of immunity to those diseases.
That actually answers the next question someone had asked. Do you see any change in titer? So,
yes.
Caller, if you need more than that, let us know. Next one is more of a, less of a question. I mean, I think it's a question. It's more of a concern. So in Dr. Sensenig, in states where we're licensed to prescribe pharmaceuticals and there are those NDs who are refusing to prescribe certain pharmaceuticals, is this something that we can get in trouble for?
You know, I don't know the answer to that, but it really pushes my buttons because I'm going to go back to that pneumonia case that I had. I said to this young female graduate of the, well, I won't tell you where, who had this patient, when I confirmed that the child had pneumonia, what I said was, he has pneumonia. What do you want to do? And she said, chest x-ray and antibiotics. And I looked at her with a puzzled look and said, why would you do that? Her answer was, well, that's the standard of care, isn't it? My answer was, whose standard of care? You're a naturopathic physician. And frankly, you're in a state where you can't prescribe. Now, I keep hearing this argument all the time that if you have access to the pharmaceuticals that are used by the allopathic profession, then you're going to be held to the allopathic standard. We keep saying that enough and keep believing that enough, that's going to be true. And without leadership in the profession that understands what I'm talking about and insists that we have our own doctrines, tenets, and standards, those are legal terms, unless our boards of examiners and our institutions understand that this is a separate and distinct healing art with its own standards of care, I fear that, in fact, you will be judged by the allopathic standard. And that leads to another question, which has nothing to do with the subject at hand that we just talked about, but the subject of the profession and its survival. If we're going to do allopathic medicine and we're going to be judged by the allopathic standard, who needs you? There are a million MDs in this country. There are a few thousand naturopaths. And believe me, as a guy who's been around this political situation for 40 years, as the architect of many of our licensing laws, as somebody who's testified in most states and who's been before committees in Washington, D.C., this argument that I'm making now is not lost on the policymakers. The time will come when they will say, if you naturopathic doctors are doing what the conventional people do, why do we need separate schools? Why do we need separate licensing? If you're going to do what we do, we should be regulating you. That's one of my greatest fears, because the profession could be, should be, and is, in the way I understand it, a separate and distinct healing art, which needs to state its own standards clearly and explicitly and have them not only backed up by, but enforced by, our boards of examiners. Unfortunately, I don't know the answer to the question that the questioner put forward, though.
Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Sensenig. I'm really with you on this topic and agree with you that we have very effective treatments. But I recently had a mother come and see me whose son was in the ICU with tetanus.
Mm-hmm.
It was really troubling, you know, because you
right.
never see that, right?
Right.
So,
right.
You know, I think perhaps tetanus, I'm not really aware of that particular vaccination being having negative side effects as much as some of the other ones. You know, to that degree, do you agree that there are certain vaccinations we should embrace?
You know, I'm not sure how to answer that because I think it would seem that those things that we fear the most, like tetanus and polio, maybe we should be immunized against them. And certainly there's an argument to be made there that would make sense, and forget about the chickenpox and the mumps and the measles and all this other stuff that the vaccine companies are now, you know, purveying. However, it seems like from the exemption point of view, from the religious exemption or medical exemption point of view, it's kind of all or nothing. You're either in favor of, or particularly the religious side, you're either in favor of or, I mean, you're either opposed to or you're in favor of doing vaccination. And how do you explain the one or the other? So I guess one of the questions that I would have, this is more a philosophical question. Did you have an opportunity to treat this young man who had tetanus? I mean,
no.
I wonder how he would have responded to naturopathic treatments. I mean,
definitely.
I'm told,
yeah.
I mean, that's theoretical because I've never seen anybody with tetanus. But as I said before, I was taught in school that here's what you do. You use the Leadum or you use the tetanus nosode or other remedies, Lathyrus, and there are others that our predecessors were using before the tetanus toxoid. And didn't I just read something, maybe somebody who's listening knows this better than I do, that the tetanus toxoid is now being called into question because it doesn't confer immunity, where did I just read that? It's not as clear-cut as we'd like to believe. So I don't, you know, you raise a really interesting question. You see, a person who has the sequelae of one of these infections, what are you going to do? But one might say that even still, that maybe that child could be treated if you had the opportunity to do so. Don't know. I don't
okay.
know.
Okay, so I'm going to move on. Here we go. Next question. You're on. Or not. Okay.
Hello?
Yeah, you're on.
Me?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Hi,
hey, Tim.
Whoa.
Blessings. I'm so happy. I admire you so much. I'm so grateful that you're actually speaking out because we don't get a lot of this in school. I had a question. How long do you wait after prophylactic dosing the NOSO to run the titers?
Oh, I don't think there's any magic to that at all. Anywhere from immediately after to a couple weeks. I mean, because you're my understanding is that you're increasing those titers in direct response to what you're doing. And now if you look at books like what I mentioned, if you look at like the Vaccine Free and other books where people have done this, there's like no real protocol.
Right.
Pick a dose, you know, do a 200C, you know, once a week for a month or once a day for a week or whatever.
Okay.
You know, okay, I want to say something about the previous call as well, about the child with tetanus. The thing is that, and this is very hard to know, and she was talking about it's a patient of hers, I think she said. What about the susceptibility side? You know, of those who are infected, what is different, if anything, about him? And I'm not using, I don't know this person, so obviously I'm not trying to get personal, but, you know, does this person have enough zinc and enough selenium, and are they getting enough vitamin E and vitamin C and vitamin D and so on and so forth? I mean, how often do we look at those things, and what have we done to assure that our patients are as healthy as possible? And, of course, none of us is doing all that we can because that's not what people are coming to us for, and we're not, particularly with newer patients, we may not have the opportunity to do things that would have improved their health to the point where they're resistant anyway. So anyway, just a thought. So anyway, and titers, just do your thing and then, you know, just give it a short amount of time and redo the titers. No magic.
The next question is also about titers. How long do the titers stay elevated, do we know?
That's a good question. I do not know. How long do they stay elevated with vaccination?
I have no idea.
Again, let me be clear. It's that the argument about the vaccination is the way it's done, not what's done. You can't use this word, I suppose, but you can do what the vaccinations are doing in a way that is safer and more cost-effective than the vaccinations. And you could do, if you were wanting to do this, now, the legal side of this aside for a second, you could put somebody through the entire CDC vaccination schedule with the nosodes and demonstrate that they have immunity to whatever you're doing there, right? So in the case of tetanus that was brought up, it's my understanding that you could be administering the tetanus nosode instead of a tetanus booster, for example, and produce the same results.
Okay. Let's see. I have a comment from a doc who says, I'm loving the CE by Dr. Sensenig. I don't even need the CE for the rest of the year. Please invite him to do more. So I thought that I should tell you that.
Thank you.
Also, I found a device, and I sent it to your email. I don't know if you're sitting in front of your computer or not, but I found a device that does UV into the mouth. And it's a small device. I don't know if it would work. If you get a chance to look at it, let me know so I can let everybody else know. I already sent the link out. It's uva.com, and it's a little handheld unit. That was very intriguing to me, so I looked it up quick. So you can get them. But that's the only one that I found, and I looked at about 60 different products. Everything else is big. You know, you run it over your countertop or your blanket or your couch or whatever. Okay, I'm going to try. I know we have a caller who has a question. So your phone ends in 5974. I'm going to unmute you if you still want to ask your question. You're unmuted if you'd like to ask your question.
Hello. Hi, Dr. Sensenig.
Hello.
Hello. I've always... you've always been a great inspiration for me since day one at SCNM when you did the intensive. I think As a recent graduate, I've only been out in practice now starting my third year. I think the fear that what I'm seeing, and maybe even in myself a little bit, but I always go back to things that you taught, was that we don't get the same kind of training that you did when you were in medical school. And so when we really want to help someone that does have that hasn't been vaccinated, or how can we immunize them without vaccinations, or how do you treat whooping cough or tetanus, that isn't shown to us in medical school. And I think that is like taking our power away as naturopaths, because we don't have that in our toolbox if that's what to be presented to us. And it's really disheartening at this point in our profession, in the direction that it's going, that we don't even have that in our toolbox anymore.
I couldn't agree
with
you more.
It's not really a question, just a comment.
Yeah, so I couldn't agree with you more, and you bring up two points that I want to make. One of them is that, firstly, you use the word afraid and fear, and that is exactly the tool of allopathic medicine. We learn to live in fear, in this case, in fear of germs and what can happen. And so the decisions are driven from that point of view. And it's not just the germs and vaccination and antibiotics. It's everything else. I mean, how many times have you heard a medical doctor say to a patient, well, if you don't do this, this is going to happen. You know, if you don't treat your hypertension, you're going to have a stroke. If you don't do this, you're going to end up with this, you know. So the motivator in allopathic medicine is not, let's have you be as healthy as you can be. It's, if you don't, this will happen. The other thing is that if you haven't, as you just said to me, if you haven't seen this done, if you haven't had this demonstrated to you, you're not going to have the confidence in the medicine that I think you should as a naturopathic doctor. We're not trying to do what the other guys do by using other things in place of their drugs. We're coming at this from a completely different point of view. So I couldn't agree with you more. And it worries me. It worries me. If there's a converging, I come back to that comment I made a few minutes ago. If there's a converging evolution here, which is what's happening in so-called integrated medicine, you have medical doctors trying to do what you're doing, and we have naturopaths who are trying to do what they're doing, explain to me the rationale for naturopathy.
Well, so this is Eli. I'm just wondering if this isn't really a kind of nice prelude to, you know, why you're trying to do what you're trying to do with offering more education in the coming year, so people can actually learn how to practice the naturopathic medicine you were taught to practice.
Well, if I can toot my own horn, and you're aware of this, is one of the things that I'm hoping to do with some of my colleagues is to begin to teach what we learned 30 and 40 years ago so that you will have the tools and the confidence you need to practice real naturopathic medicine, not only how to practice, but the politics and the philosophy. This actually pushes one of my buttons, and I'm assuming people on the call are interested in this subject, so I'm going to mention it. I think we have to be, well, let me tell you where I'm coming from. I understand naturopathic medicine as a distinct healing art that has its own way of understanding things, and it's served me well for 40 years. I think this may sound a little over the top, but I'm going to say it anyway. I feel like most of my patients, and I hope this is true for all of you, I feel as though most of my patients get better. And it doesn't matter what you're talking about. Now, sure, there are people who don't get better, and there are people who don't want to do what it takes to do that, but I feel like with the simple principles of naturopathic medicine, I have something to offer most everyone, and I see incredible results. There's a cogent, articulable philosophy that directs itself at how healing occurs and what health is and how one achieves that. And that's what our predecessors from Lindlar to Kent, Hahnemann, Spittler, Wendell, and many, many others have articulated in their textbooks. That's different than trying to develop a vitalist philosophy that explains what we're doing today. And it's a subtle distinction, but I think we need to continue to go back to the basics, which haven't changed in, you know, several centuries. And the philosophy of naturopathic medicine textbook is trying to articulate that, and hopefully that'll be available in the next year or two.
We really appreciate you being here with us and sharing your years of wisdom and knowledge and being willing to help hold that candle up for us to follow through these dim and murky times. Dr. Sensenig, thank you.
Thank you.